Let me take your number down, and and play a song, and we'll see what we can do here. All righty?
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
So we're going to play another one of Amakayla's pieces. Actually, maybe we'll play a little bit of Angela Wellman's Back on Track. That kind of fits thematically.
Hello,
Dagmar. I tried calling you, and this is the number that you told me to call you on, so I can't call you.
Okay. Well,
so I'm confused.
Okay, let's just go ahead then.
Yeah, because the number that you sent me is the number that I, that is this number. So, you want to start all over again?
Yes.
Yeah, because I, yeah, so anyway. Well, you've been in the studio the whole time, and I just wanted to tell you that your film, that screening is a part of the Berlin and Beyond Film Festival, Audre Lorde, the Berlin Years, 1984 to 1992, which I was sort of in the process of introducing, but I'll let you continue, is really a remarkable and probably little-known story in Audre Lorde's illustrious life. And I wanted to know if you could talk a little bit about it. Let me introduce you to our audience. Director Dagmar Schultz was born in Berlin, Germany. She first studied at the Free University of Berlin and then studied and worked in the United States and in Puerto Rico from 1963 to 1972. Between 1963 and 1965, she taught speech, direction, and production of documentary films, journalism, and theater. In 1965, she taught at Rust College in Holly Springs, Mississippi, and was active in the civil rights movement. In 1969 to 1970, she taught at Columbia College in Chicago. She received her PhD from the University of Wisconsin at Madison with a dissertation on workers' education in 1972, and her
Habilitation.
Yeah, from the Free University of Berlin with a study on the life and work of women and men professors. You've taught at the John F. Kennedy Institute of North American Studies at the Free University of Berlin from 1973 to 1986. Women's Studies and Cultural and Immigration Issues, and from 1991 to 2004, you were professor of social work at the Alice
Solomon
University of Applied Sciences in Berlin, Germany. Your teaching and research have focused on feminist studies and women's movements, on anti-racist social work, on women's health and health care, and on cultural competence in the psychiatric care of migrants and minorities. And after 1974, and in 1974, after your return to Berlin, you were co-founder of the Feminist Women's Health Center in Berlin in 1974, the first of its kind in Germany, and you worked at the center until 1981. You also co-founded Orlando's Women's Press in 1974, and you were its co-publisher into 2001.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, you got like a big, long, but we're almost at the end of it, so I might as well keep on going. It's in the program, folks, if you want to go to. let's talk about the film because we don't have
that much time because we had
this snafu in the beginning. So tell us about Audre Lorde and how you came to, as I was just looking, it's like, wow, the camera was everywhere. How did you happen to meet Audre Lorde and to be able to make this wonderful film?
Well, I met her in Copenhagen in 1980 at the UN World Women's Conference, and heard her read there and then have a discussion. And I was just very, very impressed by her and thought, well, it would just be wonderful if she could come to Germany. And since I was teaching at the Institute of North American Studies at the Free University of Berlin, I could try to organize that. So I asked her whether she would be interested in coming, and she said yes, she might be. Mm-hmm. And it took them quite a while, took until 1984 till it finally materialized. And then Audre was a guest professor at the Free University. She taught three courses there and met black Germans.
Mm-hmm.
When she arrived in Berlin, she was already saying, well, where are the black Germans? And she then encouraged women who came to her classes to write, and that became the book Showing Our Colors, Afro-German Women Speak Out, which is published in English by the University of Massachusetts Press, and which, contains the history of black people and people of African descent in Germany, and includes also interviews and stories by Afro-German women of three different generations. So that was, you know, that was the initial part of Audrey's, you know, contribution in Germany. And she then was kind of instrumental in initiating with others the Black German movement. So, and that was a really, for her, a really important experience, and of course for everyone else there too. She was also very, very influential with white women, and not just women, in getting them to realize their white skin privileges and become more conscious of how to use their powers, you know, which she always emphasized. You know. She always said everyone has a certain degree of power, and it's important to find out for yourself what that is and to use it before someone uses it against you.
Mhm. Yeah. Tell us about the Afro Germans. I thought it was really interesting that in the film that the Germans of African descent didn't even know anyone of African descent. I mean, that's how, fragmented they were within the society. I mean, it wasn't like there was a community that everyone could know everyone else. And I just thought it was, it was great. It was also really interesting that just Audre Lorde sort of posing that question and being, you know, the dynamic person that she was able to, sort of start, you know, this movement there. And I was wondering if you could talk about sort of the ancestry of African people in Germany, people of African descent in Germany, and how it went back a lot further than maybe popular media had said. I thought those interviews were really, really great.
Yeah, well, as Audrey says in the film, that she herself found out that there were generations of African of people of African descent in Germany, and not just what everyone thought in the general society, that it was the children of Black PIs from 1940, the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
So, you had a generation which predated the colonial period, but then also, people who came through the colonial period to Germany, and in the film you see an interview with a woman who was a child of a man from Cameroon who came to Germany and who married, and she and her sister went through the Weimar period and the Nazi period, and had all kinds of experiences that relate in the book, Showing Our Colors.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing was that generation actually had a community. They were talking of their country people, and they had, an infrastructure also of, how they would get together, and where they had clubs, and that was something that was disrupted by National Socialism. And the generation after the Second World War, that was then, the most isolated one. That was the children of GIs were most isolated, because the GIs went back to the United States, and very often there was no further contact between the mothers and the fathers. And then again, you had generation in the 60s where, it was people who came from African countries to study in Germany, and who then had relations with white Germans. And those children often lived, or at least for part of their youth, in the country of the father, or, had an African community, student community in Germany. So they had a tie to Africa, which the post-war generation did not have. So you get different patterns there of community and of consciousness. And that's something that was kind of hidden, you know, in Germany as well as in the outside world. People did not even think of people of African descent as part of members of the German white society.
Mhm. Right. Yeah. So in the ensuing years from when the Afro German organizations sprung up that were created to encourage gatherings, community gatherings, so people of, you know, African descent in Germany could get to know one another. Are any of those organizations that you mentioned, that are mentioned in the film, still around? And if you could name some of them.
Yeah. There's the main organization is the ISB, the Initiative of Black Germans.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Initiative of Black in Germany. And because it has, you know, it's including not only Black Germans, but also other Blacks who live in Germany. And then there's ADEFRA, the Afro-German Women's Organization. And there are all kinds of, on the internet you find all kinds of other groups. But the ISB is the one that you find in all kinds of cities in Germany, and they have a national gathering which takes place once a year for 3 days, where people come together to have workshops, but also to socialize, to dance. There are a lot of children who are included in all kinds of activities, and there's a lot of, if you look on the internet on the Black community in Germany, or Black Germans, Black in Germany, there's a lot of internet presence of different activities and organizations that engage in anti-racist work. So that would be the best way to find out. For instance, mm-hmm. called the Brown Mob. It's an internet organization that relates the activities of local initiatives.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. Are you working with any of those organizations in particular?
Well, I myself am not. I'm a white German, so I'm not in those organizations except for, you know, related activities. But Ika Hugel Marshall and Ria Cheatham, who are co-authors of the script for the film,
mm-hmm.
you know, they are members. They are active, and the other women, you know, the other Black women who are interviewed in the film are in active in various ways. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It just seems like this, you know, her question triggered sort of an end to the isolation that it seems that the Afro-Germans were experiencing for the most part.
Well, you know, it's also, I guess, important to say that there would have been a movement eventually, even if Audrey would not have been in Germany,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, there were movements developing in those years in various countries. But she was just very important in giving it a name, that the women, for instance, decided to call themselves Afro-German, and they did not have that name for themselves before. And, they were all just very, names which were discriminatory, like mulatto or
mm-hmm.
still the Negro, you know, which was a common expression still in the 70s. And her visions and ideas and her challenges to people were just really important, you know, in terms of giving the movement the direction. And she just gave the women an incredible amount of strength to believe in themselves and to know that they could, you know, could affect something by getting together and by making themselves visible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This it's what's really amazing is how your camera, seemed to capture some really wonderful moments. That I was reading that are previously unreleased, and this particular year is is an anniversary of Audre Lorde's passing. She was born February 18th, 1934, and she passed November 17th, 1992. And I was wondering if the timing of the film is intentional, and if you could talk about sort of being able to, having your camera ready to just sort of filming Audre Lorde dancing, you know, at this wonderful party. Those, you know, walking in the park, and just some really wonderful personal moments of her, as well as the archival footage of her, you know, sharing her poetry and lecturing, which was great too, the way you wove that into the piece. Along with the interviews of Afro-Germans, which we've already been speaking of. It's just really, really well done, delightful film that actually screened here as a part of Frameline this summer. But you weren't here.
Yes, I was here.
Oh, you were here?
I was here for Frameline, yes.
Oh, excellent, excellent. Well, yeah, really, yeah, because I asked the person who told me about the film. He said, oh, no, the director wasn't there. But yes, you were.
Oh,
He must have been at the screening you weren't at. Or something, I don't know. Yeah, but in our closing moments, I wonder if you could talk about sort of the film itself and also the timing of the film.
Okay, the timing... Well, this is the 20th anniversary of Audre's passing, and I have worked on this film for quite a while, and it was clear to me it had to be done by now. Mm-hmm. And the making of the film, I took a lot of photos of Audre, and Audre Lorde was somebody who liked to take photos herself, mm-hmm. and so she did not mind that. She kind of considered me her house photographer, and in the last 2 years of her life, I had first camcorder, then I started taking videos. Some of the material in the film comes from Third World Newsreel, who put out the film Litany for Survival, mm-hmm. Life and Work of Audre Lorde.
Yeah,
they came in 1989 to Berlin and filmed her there, mm-hmm. and did not use a lot of the material. And I could kind of buy it from them. They are also the distributor for the present film. For the education market, and so she did not mind me taking pictures, but I did not have a mind to make a film. I just felt this was a really important period in my life and the lives of others around me, and I wanted to just hold on to it. So I took a lot of audio also of her readings and discussions of her courses, and transcribed all that, for the film. So the audio was a really important part of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then I decided, I had this trove of material which I did not want to keep to myself and wanted to share it with as many people as possible. So I decided to make a film and to look for a filmmaker. Well, eventually I just found this really excellent editor, Aletta von Dietinghoff, and Ika and Rhea and I delivered a four-hour script to her, and she, in constant discussion with us, she developed this 8-minute film, and yeah, that's how it came about.
Mm-hmm. Right,
and the
right.
Private moments, I always wanted to show Audre on stage and off stage, because
mm-hmm.
Audre Lorde is someone who, as many people say, put on a pedestal or considered like an icon. And I wanted to, knowing her so well, I wanted to humanize her too. And I guess another connection that needs to be mentioned is that when Audre came to Berlin in 1984,
mm-hmm.
she was given a 6-month prognosis of life. And she started alternative medicine in Germany. She worked with a doctor first and then a healing, a naturopath with mistletoe treatment,
mm-hmm.
and other homeopathic treatments. And that's something that apparently really helped her maintain her health for the next years. of course, in concert with, you know, her own personality and, you know, how she led her life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's really wonderful, you know, showing, you know, because one wouldn't even know that, you know, that she was fighting for her life, and she had already lived past
the
estimation.
I want to mention that the film is going to be distributed by Duaga Design in Oakland for the home video market,
mm-hmm.
and actually it's arriving this week with about 70 minutes of special features, which are very interesting material,
mm-hmm.
and also in four subtitles in four languages,
mm-hmm.
German, it's going to be in English, but then German, French, and Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
So this is Duaga Design, D as in David, or as in Dora, R-A-G-A Design,
mm-hmm.
in Oakland, by J.B., that's the name of the owner of the company.
Oh, excellent. Oh, well, that's perfect timing, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the film, will you have the film? Will the film be available at the screening on Saturday?
It should be. Yeah.
Because if it's ready this week, it could be ready in
time
for you to get to have some copies.
I mean, it's on the way with UPS.
Right.
It should be there by Saturday.
Excellent, excellent. Oh well, you're definitely going to have copies there. Oh, that's super. Oh, that's wonderful. Wow. Well, maybe at some point we might be able to give away a few copies. That would be kind of cool. Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Dagmar, for making this wonderful film. It's fantastic. And,
and
Audre Lorde is just such a wonderful spirit to lift up, and her name is just, she's just did so much. And you know, to show this part of her life that is little known.
And it was really great that it premiered, had its world premiere at the Berlin Film Festival, which, you know, is a big one.
Yes.
So since then, since February, it has been going around the world, and we're just getting very positive reactions. And we're happy about any comments that you send, which we can also put on the website to show people's reactions.
Okay, certainly.
Okay.
Yes. You've been making the rounds this year.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations.
Okay. Oh, maybe one more mention. We're going around the United States with the Audre Lorde Legacy Cultural Festival, which includes this, the new film, plus Litany, and the film The Edge of Each Other's Battles.
Oh, yeah, that was made here. Yeah.
Yeah, Life and Vision of Audre Lorde by Jennifer Abbott, and a film on Mai Ayim, Ghanaian German poet, Hope in My Heart, the Mai Ayim story, which is distributed by Third World Newsreel, and a reading by Ika Hugemar from her book Invisible Woman.
Oh yeah, that's going to be screening with your film on Saturday.
She's actually here, and she's going to be reading live in the Casper Theater. Yeah.
Wow, that's going to be awesome.
We were at Berkeley University yesterday, so that.
Oh, you were at UC Berkeley. Okay.
UC Berkeley, and we're going tomorrow to Sonoma State University, and then we're going to be in the Casper Theater, which is really exciting.
Oh.
It's a wonderful place to be.
Nice, nice. So where is the Audre Lorde Film Festival happening?
Well, we just came from the University of Hawaii. That was the beginning.
Okay.
And from here we're going to Chicago, which is also where Ika's, her father's family is living. And then we're going to be at Northwestern and at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And then we're going to be at Du Bois Institute at Harvard, University of Massachusetts, Union College, and at the end, Hunter College on October 16 in New York, at Hunter College in New York, which was audited, you know, the college for auditors.
Right. Oh, darn. So
and you find all that also on the calendar of the website.
Yeah.
The website is Audre Lorde minus the Berlin years.
Yeah, darn. So you're just bypassing the West Coast completely.
We're here.
I'm talking about the film festival. That would be really nice if you were coming back through with the film festival. But we're happy that you're here.
Yeah,
as a part of Berlin and beyond.
Yeah, and it was already in Seattle at the Langston Hughes African American Film Festival. And at the Film Festival in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So after
right.
Frame Line.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but those are past.
Oh, yeah. Which one are you thinking of now?
Oh, I'm talking about this film festival you're talking about, the one that I didn't know about, the one where you're going to be showing all these films about Audre
yeah.
Lorde, that film festival, not Berlin and Beyond,
oh, I see.
Not
okay.
just showing
yeah.
your film.
Yeah,
yeah that's what
yeah.
I'm talking about, that
yeah.
you're not California's, the West Coast is not a part of that tour this time. But hopefully you'll do it again.
Yeah. Well, I don't quite understand because
no,
we are,
I, hmm.
with this Audre Lorde Legacy Film Festival, which we are offering,
mm-hmm.
you know, we are now, we were in Berkeley.
Right.
And, you know, the universities can pick from that. You know, not all of them are doing the whole program.
Mm-hmm.
Like Hawaii did the whole program, and
mm-hmm.
Northwestern
oh, okay.
is doing the whole program. But some just want to do the new film and the reading with Ika Hugo Marshall.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. No, we got that.
Okay. Well, thank you, Dagmar.
Yeah.
And I'm going to try to get over to the Castro Theater to see the film again with an audience and hear the reading by Ilka. That should be really lovely.
Okay. Good.
All right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe we'll see each other there. Please introduce yourself.
Oh, certainly, certainly. Well, you take good care. Thank you so much for joining
okay,
us this morning.
Yeah. Thank All you.
Right. Sure.
Bye.
Bye-bye. So we're speaking to Dagmar Schultz, the director of Audre Lorde, the Berlin Years, 1984 to 1992, which is a part of Berlin and Beyond Film Festival, which is opening on the 27th, and it goes to October 4th, and it's got some great offerings. And we're talking about one film in particular, which is going to be screening on Saturday, September 29th at 1 p.m. There's a reading and a film. We are joined in the studio by one of my favorite directors, artists, poets, Ayodelian Zynga. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing well. I'm doing well. So the your theater season is starting. You've got an original piece that you're going to be premiering, and then you're going to be doing one of August Wilson's works. Let me introduce you, Ayo, and then you can tell us about the play by William Crossman and the piano lesson. Ayodele Nzinga, the director of the Laura Bottom Players, which is a theater that's housed at the Sister Thea Bowman Memorial Theater, which is a really wonderful theater right in West Oakland. She has MA, MFA, and a PhD. So you have your PhD now.
Yes.
Congratulations. Whoa, how lovely. You are a writer, educator, playwright, director, and performance artist who uses art as a medium of conversation within marginalized populations. So tell us about your theater. And and I actually was at the play that I believe you wrote about Sister Thea Bowman, and then at the inauguration of that wonderful theater.
Well, the theater was built for me 11 years ago by Dr. Washington Burns, the executive director of the Prescott Joseph Center.
Mm-hmm.
And my troupe, the Lower Bottom Players, have been the troupe in residence there since the theater was built for me. We specialize in art that speaks to marginalized communities and speaks for them. I started off becoming rather popular for doing adaptations of plays that we would take and we would then set in West Oakland, which just sort of underlined one of the reasons I put my practice here, because I think it's emblematic of all kinds of oppressed places throughout globally. So by taking things written by Shakespeare or things written by Hansberry or things written by Baldwin and locating them in Oakland, I sort of made West Oakland the center of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I found another playwright who had done nearly the same thing. He had a great predilection with a certain geographical area, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, August Wilson. And I discovered the America's Shakespeare. Wilson is bar none the best American playwright living or dead. People liken him to O'Neill. Everybody gets, you know, an opinion. I think that Wilson is the best. He, his feat of taking the entire North American African experience and distilling it into 10 installations, each covering a decade, is brilliant. It's going to live forever. I am currently on the fourth of those plays. I've made a commitment to direct the entire century cycle in order. We did Jim of the Ocean and Joe Turner's Come and Gone last year. This year, we open with Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and we are closing our official season with a piano lesson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is your season opening this Sunday? Is it Sunday?
Our season opens in July. With
Ma
Rainey's.
Already open. Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, this is our second Wilson piece for the year.
Okay.
And we're closing our official season because we're an outdoor theater. A lot of people don't know that until they get there. We are an outdoor theater. It is a beautiful place. Mm-hmm. But because it's outdoors, it doesn't have a ceiling. So we operate in the summer. We do a summer theater camp while children are out, and then we do at least 2 full-length productions a year. We are also going to be presenting some shorts there on the 29th. On the 29th, the day before the San Francisco Theater Festival, mm-hmm. on the 29th of September, we're going to be presenting Will Crossman's Ragdoll Lullaby, which was written by Mr. Crossman for the Lower Bottom Players. And I'm going to be presenting a new work called North American Griot. All of this work, interestingly, ties into some work you're doing. Maafa, in that all of it is memory work. All of it celebrates memory. Wilson, for me, has been very, very spiritual work. He always talks about Africans finding their song. I've decided their song is their ashe, their spiritual force, the thing that musicians sell for money, the thing that actors offer up so that they can live in comfort, the thing that writers pull on the pages in order to become famous. The thing about the song is if you actually lose control of it, then you sort of lost and you wander looking for it, or you wander not knowing that that's what you're looking for. So it also ties Wilson's work into movement, because we are a people who are so connected to the term movement, both literal and figuratively, the fact that we are involuntary migrants, the fact that we left the South on several occasions in a large group, there have been at least 2 large northern migrations where we left looking for opportunity. Currently in the Bay, we're being driven. We're losing the majority toehold here in Oakland and being driven to places like Antioch, Stockton, and Fresno. Movement is not always synonymous with success, and Wilson begs us to consider that. He begs us to consider where our strength lies, and our strength lies in remembering, and our strength lies, if we remember, then we remember unity. We remember when we were more effective. We remember when our song was clearer to us. Oddly, the work that Crossman has written for us is very similar work. It's work that deals with the lack of control in the life of the oppressed. It's done very cleverly through a flashback that's centered around the rag doll that takes us from modern day time back to a slave auction. Mm. And it's a very short and very powerful piece. It talks about the ability to control one's own movement, the freedom to own your own song. And, of course, my work, North American Griot, is very similar work. It's memory work, work that owns the story of coming here, being the seed of dungeons, but then turns that story all the way open, where you see what a miraculous feat it is that we still are, that that is a story of thriving, of resilience, of victory over the meanest kind of oppression. And it's a stubborn holding on to the song, the remembering that keeps us afloat.
Yeah. So what time are these two plays, Ragdoll Lullaby and your piece?
Those pieces
that Ragdoll Lullaby is going to be performed twice. Well, it's going to be performed
three times.
Okay.
Three times on the 29th.
Okay.
At 4, 5, and 6 shows are running. And it's a fundraiser, so we'll be selling barbecue that day. We're calling it Theater, Poetry, and Barbecue.
Nice.
That's a $17 barbecue and the show. You can, of course, just come and see the show. It costs you $10. Or you can just come by and buy some food and support the work. The next day, we're going to the San Francisco Theater Festival, which is over in the Tenderloin this year. And we will be performing over there at around between 12 and 2, the theater festival itself goes from 11 to 4.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, and you put the information there, which is really great. The website is sftheaterwitherfestival.org for all of the information about the film festival. Yeah, and so you're going to be having these different performance times. You mentioned 4, 5, and 6, and then on October 20th,
Theater, poetry, barbecue, 4, 5, and 6, the same thing. Now, don't want to forget that the piano lesson.
Right, that's opens, October 4th.
October. It previews October 4th. And we're not telling anybody, but you run through and get some barbecue on October 4th, too.
Okay.
So you'll be able to buy plates on the 4th, too.
Okay.
That's a preview. It opens officially on the 5th.
Okay.
So it will be at a 7 o'clock curtain on the 5th and the 6th, a 2 o'clock matinee on the 7th. Mm-hmm. And then it runs next week, the following weekend. And, again, the Friday and the Saturday show are at 7 o'clock, and the matinee is at 2.
Right, yeah. So
you can purchase tickets in advance for anything of ours on our website at www.lowerbottomplayers.com. And Playas is spelled PLAYAZ.
Right. Yeah, tell us about your company. You've got some residents there that have been with you for a while.
Yeah, I'm sitting on some heavy talent out here in the West. We, one of our mainstays is a brother named Adimu Magyun. He's also known as Wolfhawk Jaguar. He has one of the hottest albums going right now. It's actually been nominated for a Grammy. It is Hunter Poetry. It's a whole new kind of world music. If you haven't heard Hunter Poetry yet, you need to go to iTunes. It's available everywhere. iTunes, Amazon, any place you can buy music, you can buy Hunter Poetry. He'll be playing Doker in the piano lesson. He's not to be missed. He is a very talented musician, but he is he's a wonderful actor. And we also have Karan Streets. Karan's got new music out, too. You know, I got it, Volume 2, available on iTunes. He plays Lyman. And it's a very, very different role for Karan. We're used to seeing Karan. Karan was Levy in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. So we just see him be this very, very hot-headed guy who stabs his compatriot. He is the polar opposite in this play, as is Stanley Hunt, who is developing quite a little following. He just finished starring in a movie called Licks that should be out in theaters next summer. Karan Streets was in Licks, too. Stanley actually stars. And he just played Toledo in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, and a quiet sort of philosophical character. And this time around, he's Boy Willie, again, a polar opposite in the piano lesson. So I think people that have been following Karan and Stanley will get a kick of seeing them cast differently than they are normally cast. They're both doing really, really fine work. We have a couple of newcomers that people are going to be thoroughly shocked by, too. I've got a 16-year-old sleeper on stage, and it would be interesting to see if people can even pick out which one is the 16-year-old. He's carrying such a tremendous talent. And then another new face, Lucian Baker, who is, again, sitting on just tremendous talent. It's going to be a wonderful show.
Yeah, it sounds like it's going to really be fantastic. Wow, sounds really excellent. So tell our audience a little bit about the story of the piano lesson. Their spirits that are talking to the family. And your set design is always really fantastic. And sometimes you set the play, you know, right in the community where your theater is located. Are we in Pittsburgh or are we in Oakland in this particular
We're in Pittsburgh because Wilson lets me do that. And actually, this is Pittsburgh. With Wilson, I stopped doing adaptations. I'll need to. Wilson has the story there, and once again, it helps me make the point that oppressed spaces are emblematic because the story, Wilson's story of Pittsburgh, is my story of West Oakland. The final play in the Century Cycle ends with a play called Radio Golf that's about gentrification. So as I sit here in a rapidly gentrifying space, the story is eerily the same. Wilson also has another characteristic that the young people in my cast always find amazing because he's talking about the past, but he's still talking about right now, always. And it's a unique thing to Wilson plays. The piano lesson, all of his plays are about spirits and ancestors and remembering. So in this particular play, he brings in the dual problem of holding on to ancestry, the privilege of remembering, the ability to remember, because sometimes you're forced to forget. If you need to eat, then, and you need to act in a certain way to enable you to eat, then some people are quite comfortable with acting the way they need to so they can eat, even if it's contrary to what they know to be proper and right. Wilson urges us to hold on to ancestry, to remember, to be informed by remembering. So if you're informed by remembering the certain things you probably are not going to be able to do, you probably are not going to be able to be complicit in your own oppression because you remember. Mm-hmm. He also talks about how sometimes that costs you opportunity, the desperate need to go forward. In the piano lesson, Boy Willie talks about his father's big hands and how his father said, that's all he got is his hands. And so unless he go out there and kill him somebody, ain't no good because where's the tools? And Boy Willie reasons, if he had him a piece of land, a place to stand in the world, and he wouldn't have felt like that because the land is the only thing that God ain't making no more of, and the land gives you something back as opposed to this piano that's in his sister's care that has this very interesting story that you need to come to the play to hear. But it's left the piano carved with all of the Charles's family's history. The sister won't play the piano because she said the piano invokes spirits and that her mother listened to those spirits and her mother wasn't a happy person. She's not a happy person. She lost her husband, and as the preacher who is pursuing her says, she ain't looked at a womanhood in a real long time and she done closed up. And so she's holding on to this piano because somehow she understands that it's her ancestry, that it represents her ancestors, her heritage, the family's legacy. Boy Willie wants to sell the piano because he say, piano, all you can do is sit there and look at it, especially if she ain't going to play it. And if he sells that piano, he can get him some land. If he gets him some land, he can be all right with the world. He can plant him some cotton, he can gin his seed, and he can get him something else too if he needs it because the land always gives you back something. I'm like that piano, it's just sitting there. And Gopher says maybe the piano needs to be blessed because it seems like the piano just carries a lot of trouble. And so throughout the play, people talk about, the ghost of the yellow dog. Again, you're going to have to come to the play to figure out who the ghost of the yellow dog is. Mm-hmm. And whether or not the ghost of the yellow dog is murdering a group of white people who wronged the Charles family. And the latest person that's been killed by the yellow dog is a man named Sutter. And Sutter is the descendant of the man Sutter who owned the Charles family. And the very last scene in the play is an exorcism. Again, you have to come to the play to figure out how it works out. Mm-hmm. But an exorcism that brings together concepts of Christianity and a mystic religion, ancestor worship, mm-hmm. and in Boy Willie's case, just plain old tenacity in a trilogy that is able to move and align spirits in a way that you have to come and see.
Right. And give us the information again about the theater, Ayo.
Theater is located at 920 Peralta Street in Oakland, California. The box office is 510-332-1319. You can buy tickets at the door a half an hour before shows. Shows on Fridays and Saturdays start at 7. Sunday shows are always matinees. It is an outdoor theater. Please dress warm and wear sensible shoes. BART is within walking distance. The 26 AC Transit bus stops at BART and also stops right in front of the theater. The theater is wheelchair accessible. You may buy tickets online at www.lowerbottomplayers.com. Players is spelled PLAYAZ.
Okay, and give the address for the theater again.
920 Peralta Street, Oakland, California.
Okay, right. And then this weekend is a special.
Theater Festival is the 30th of September, and we are going to be in what's called the CBD Community Room at 134 Golden Gate, and we'll be downstairs in the CBD Community Room at 134 Golden Gate, downstairs in the Tenderloin San Francisco Theater Festival. Ragdoll Lullaby will be appearing. North American Griot will be there, along with Marvin X's Plato Negro and Salam, Huey Salam by the Kirkwood Theater. And on the 29th, the day before the theater festival, in the theater at 920 Peralta Street, we're barbecuing. You can come and get you some barbecue from 3 to 7:30. We'll also have shows of Ragdoll and North American Griot at 4, 5, and 6.
Mm-hmm. Right. And when you come to the theater, you'll see this mansion right there facing you, which is the
Prescott Joseph Center for
Prescott. Right. And then the theater, you just come through the white picket fence and, you know, the gate, and just walk in the back, and that's where the theater is, right?
Call the theater in the yard, and that's where it is, in the backyard.
Yeah. Right. Well, thank you so much, Ayo, for joining us. We love to have you on the show, you know, talk about your work, and it'd be great to have you on next month to talk about your work. I didn't know you had your PhD. I know you've been working on it. But I'd love to talk to you about your scholarship and your way of doing theater, because it's more than just putting on a show. It's sort of really taking back a community and giving community voice through theater.
Art is a conversation. I'm always talking to you, always.
Right,
so.
Yeah.
It's a big, giant conversation. I would love to come back. I would love to share some of the work from North American Griot with you, mm-hmm. and talk about some of the poetry work that's happening that is totally informed by this research into my work in theater here in the community.
Mm-hmm. That'd be excellent. Okay, so we'll make that date then.
All right.
You take good care. Thank you again for joining us.
Have an excellent day. Bye-bye.
You too. Peace and blessings. We are joined in the studio by Amna Bibikar and Professor Manu Ampin, and they are joining us to talk about this fundraiser to support urgent field research in Sudan. So I want to welcome you to the show. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Amna. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. So Ancient Kush and Nubia is under threat, and the fundraiser is going to take place Saturday, October 13th from 3 to 6 at the Lennon Life Gallery in San Leandro, 770 East 14th Street. So I was wondering, Amna, these are your people. I was wondering if you could like maybe frame the issue for us, and then Professor Manu, you could talk about the work that you've been doing. Gosh, how many years now have you been, you know, sort of advancing this work and doing these field research trips?
I've been in the trenches now for a little more than two decades.
Wow.
Doing firsthand or what we call primary research.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. I remember when you told me that they were going to be flooding the pyramids, and now it's imminent, huh?
It's there, but I think that we could make an impact if we continue to organize and gain momentum. So it's if we don't do anything, then clearly some of the greatest archaeological sites in the world will be flooded forever.
Mm-hmm.
So we can't sit by and talk about African greatness on the one hand and then have the physical evidence destroyed on the other, because documentation beats conversation. So we need to be able to document the important legacy of African contributions to the world, and that's what's been motivating me for a number of years, and that's why we're involved with the Save Nubia Project.
Mhm. Yeah. So, Anna?
Yes. So the issue is that for Ancient Nubia, there's going to be a series of four dams built, and it's going to displace the people in the area of Ancient Nubia, and which is interesting because one of the dams actually flows through one of my villages in northern Sudan, and that's why I've actually gotten on board with Professor Manu and for this project, because it hits home. It hits too close to home. And it's imperative that we get the word out and we make sure that we reach out to our African people, my African people.
Tell us about the people that live there, Amna. And then Professor Manu, you can definitely join in the conversation. So Amna, tell us about your trip home, because you're African and African American. So tell us about your folks. You know, what's the name of the ethnic group? And you know, just tell us about the folks that are going to be their lives are going to be disrupted if this is not stopped, this move to flood these areas.
So I moved to Sudan last year in the springtime from March to August, and it was actually my first time, ever in another country. So, and my first time actually meeting my family there. So that neighborhood that I went to was in Omdurman and Khartoum. And my legacy or my family, we stemmed from the Nubians in the north, northern Sudan, and as well as some of us in the south. While I was there, it was really unfortunate. It was a very devastating experience because they actually split the country in half while I was there. and I was actually scheduled to visit my family in the South, along with a few of my family members. And all of a sudden, we couldn't go, and there was a lot of, you know, the war was just dying down, and you know, the peace treaty that was between the North and the South ended in the separation of the country. And so that was a very devastating experience. Not to my understanding with the Save Nubia Project, is that that region in the North, which would be like where the pyramids are of Bezerawia, and that is the ancient civilization, the first ancient civilization of the Sudanese peoples, that is going to be affected by the building of these dams. And I had actually visited that area while I was there, just to get a hands-on experience of my legacy and of the legacy of my people. And so when I met Professor Menu, I had reached out to him because I had heard of the work that he was doing, and it just intrigued me. And I was like, you know, this is definitely something that I have to get involved with. So whatever I can do to help, whatever I can do to raise awareness and let my people know what's going on, I'm going to make sure that I stay committed in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, Professor Menu, you have a BS degree in business management and an MA in history and African American studies, and your master's thesis, The Revolutionary Martin Luther King Jr., 1989, is being expanded into a two-volume work entitled Martin Luther King of the Evolution of a Revolutionary. And presently, you're teaching your tenured faculty at Contra Costa College in San Pablo, California, and an Africana study abroad professor at Merritt College in Oakland, California. And you also teach a 7-step primary research methodology course at Advancing the Research. But one of the ways you're really known for is for your educational tours to North Africa and Central Africa and East Africa. And and your extensive research, 13-country research tours to all the major museums, institutes, and libraries throughout America, Europe, and Canada, which house ancient Egyptian and Nubian artifacts. And so since 1990, you've completed several field research projects in Egypt, Nubia, and the Sudan to continue your primary research at dozens of field sites to study ancient African social organization and spiritual culture, document modern forgeries, and to record the vanishing evidence of classical African civilizations in the Nile Valley. So talk about your work in this region and what took you there first, and and sort of the urgency around this, what we'll lose if this happens. And I heard you on, I believe, Walter Turner's show talking about Egypt way back, I think, was it last year, when you all were, your conversation about sort of putting into context the Arab Spring, in quotation marks.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So anyway, talk about this, because people don't even necessarily know that there are pyramids outside of Egypt. And
you're right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Sister Juan, I appreciate the question. Basically, for me, what really attracted me to the Nile Valley back for the first time in 1990 is my father had introduced me to life-saving books and insight about African contributions and African high-level civilizations, books that had self-explanatory titles like The Destruction of Black Civilization, books like Ethiopia and the Missing Link to African History, books like The Origin of the African origin of civilization, myth or reality. I was stunned by this. Books like Stolen Legacy. And when I came across this knowledge in 1984, I was moved and motivated, and I was absolutely driven to know, because I felt I didn't know anything about anything. And when I had a chance to go to Morgan State and learn primary research methods, then I used those skill sets to go to all the museums, institutes, and libraries in Europe that had stolen ancient African artifacts from Kush, Nubia, and Kemet. And I used that experience over the period of a year in 11 European countries to then go for the first time to the Nile Valley. And when I went to Kemet, I was stunned by the greatness, the pyramids, the temples, the tombs, the ancient residential sites. And as I continued to go back to do field work, I began to notice by 94 that there was a systematic assault on the images, ancient African images and inscriptions. So I began to write about what I call the vanishing evidence of classical African civilizations, and to say and to show and document there's a systematic assault on the African historical legacy. Then I soon realized it wasn't just in Egypt. As I went further south into Nubia, same thing. The Nubians had been displaced from their homelands. Artifacts, archaeological sites had been flooded. Temples had been moved and taken to other countries to be on display. And as I continued to do research in the area, going to Sudan, and Sudan has 223 pyramids from ancient Kush in Nubia, which are twice as many as the pyramids in Egypt. But it became clear that in Sudan, the great problem now was not just people deliberately defacing images, African images on temple and tomb walls, but now we have the prospect of dams being built to flood areas. And this is supposedly to create hydroelectricity, but there's other forms of energy that could be used. There's micro hydro, there's solar energy, wind turbines, but these dams, unfortunately, a couple have already been finished, the Aswan High Dam, the Meroe Dam, but these four new dams that Sister Amnon just mentioned, these dams, if they're constructed in northern and central Sudan, they would flood critical areas of ancient Kush in Nubia. And so my concern is to raise the call for all people of goodwill and conscience to be concerned about this, because it's not just going to flood archaeological areas but destroy the ecology, but also displace well over 100,000 people. And the local people in Sudan, as Sister Amna mentioned, the local people don't agree to be displaced. So the whole region, whether we look at Egypt and Sudan, but this is also taking me, Sister Wanda, to Ethiopia. I've been doing field work in Ethiopia, and there's so much more to be done there, because there's actually now more projected dam projects in Ethiopia, in the Omo River area, that will flood out one of the most important indigenous areas in Africa, because the way of life there takes us back, a direct connection to ancient Kush and Nubia, because the people and their practices in southern Ethiopia have not changed literally in thousands of years, and they don't want to be displaced from their homeland. So that whole area is a rich archaeological area, historical area, and is rich with culture that the people themselves want to hold on to, but they also have asked those of us who are from other areas to help amplify their voice so that they can state their case that they don't want to be displaced from their homeland. And 'cause what happens with these dams, rather than improving life, the evidence from large dams is that it's the complete opposite. People are in worse poverty because, they are displaced, they're never compensated, and they're put in areas where they're not able to farm anymore, and they're not able to benefit from the rich river systems that are destroyed with these dams. So that's what my work has evolved from over the last 20 years or so, to look at the whole region. And so now we're building a team of people that have taken up that mantle. I think we're in a good position to help influence these big dam projects today.
Certainly, certainly. Yeah, I remember you telling me about it quite a few years ago, and it was urgent then, and it's really something that needs to happen, you know, with regards to stopping it, you know, presently. And Amna, it's really great, you know, that you're involved. It's always good to have, you know, someone who's actually a part of the community. I mean, you know, the Pan-African concept is something that means that we're all connected, but yeah. You're even more connected than that, you know, sort of philosophical connection, because these are your parents and grandparents, and wow. Yeah, and then Professor Maynu, I'm glad you mentioned your work in Ethiopia and the southern Ethiopians, you know, the folks that look more like, you know, the Bantu. That's a long discussion there, you know, sort of the history of that particular region and what's happened to those people that live there.
Yeah, you know, that's absolutely true. I mean, that's one of the most important things because, you know, in Ethiopia there's over 80 different ethnic groups, and half of them are in the south, and that's a region that is considered, an indigenous region for the southern peoples. It's a distinct region that's even recognized officially by the Ethiopian government. So that helps. And, you know, and we look at the geographical map and look at Ethiopia being adjacent to Sudan, so people cross the border, and you have cultures that mix and mingle. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of things to learn, a lot of things to know, and really people should also know, who are listening, is that the World Commission on Dams made it clear that no dam should be built unless the local people agree. And there's been also many different international forums dealing with the rights of indigenous people. Mm-hmm. So it's not those of us in the West simply imposing our ideas. No, we're simply giving voice to those who don't have a voice to inform people that this is one of the great issues of our time, that if it wasn't for programs such as yours, Sister Wanda, then there would be certain people who would never get the message, because CNN is not going to cover it. Mm-hmm. And other media sources are not going to cover these critical issues. But, you know, because of social media and because of the net, we're able now to use alternative sources and venues and avenues to get the word out and help organize. So this is what has been to our benefit in recent years.
Yeah. Why don't you all talk about, Amna, you can start, talk about this this fundraiser to support the field research that's happening at the Lennon Life Gallery in San Leandro, 770 East 14th Street, 3 to 6 p.m., Ancient Kush and the Nubia Under Threat program. What do you all have planned there for that? I believe your mission is going to require about $50,000 to complete and help convince UNESCO to begin protection of the sites. If you could talk about that or talk about an aspect of it, both of you, what's going to happen there, and, you know, $50,000, what does it mean to complete it and help convince UNESCO to begin the protection of the sites? Who is UNESCO?
Well, UNESCO is a branch of the United Nations. It's the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. And UNESCO has a branch, the World Heritage Committee, that really designates sites as World Heritage Sites. But for a site to be designated as such, the actual government has to also be involved in it. So our strategy is to really work with government folks to help to influence them to make a formal request, because it has to be done in that manner. But the other thing is that regardless of the government, Sudanese government's response, our effort, regardless of that, is to document the case. So we need 50,000 minimal, and that's totally minimal, to have to field a research team of 7 to 8 people and have a film crew, so that we can produce a very high-quality documentary from our field work over a 3-week period, to be able to raise the unmistakable, unavoidable conclusion or issue that these are some of the most important archaeological sites in the world and that they should be valued and preserved. And that's really why we're having the fundraiser, to inform the community, to gain more momentum and to generate funds to do this field work. But so we have several goals, and the goals are to fund the field research, but also to help the local people, the Nubians in particular, to build two or three museums in their local areas, and then also to get these sites recognized as World Heritage Sites, because it would be much more difficult then for someone to come along and damage what's a part of the international heritage that comes from Sudan. So that's really what our effort's about. And of course, people who may be listening that are not local, who can't come and join us on October 13th at the Lenin Life Gallery, they certainly can go online. Our site is savenubia.org, but they can go online to PayPal just and send contributions in that way too. Just the email will be info@savenubia.org, and we accept all donations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Amna, what's going to happen as a part of that the fundraising program? Are you going to, you're a wonderful poet. Are you going to be sharing any of your work, any of your journals, or any of your stories about your travels? Any poetry? Are you going to be what's happening that that particular afternoon next month?
Well, as far as the program, I'm not quite sure exactly how the program is going to go, but I know that everything that Professor Menu has just covered, being the main goals, the main focus of the event. To my understanding, I believe that Paradise is going to be there performing as well, his poetry. Should there be that option, then I would love to. I would love to perform some poetry.
Yes, you should.
Because I have written a few poems letting folks know about the issue for Save Nubia and how it's going to erase our history, erase my history. So I hope that everyone comes out, and I hope that the outreach that both I and Professor Manu and our team have been doing pays off tremendously, and we see a lot of folks come and support.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. See, in our closing moments, it's always really helpful to sort of see, the people that are being impacted, as opposed to them being sort of a vague concept. And I was wondering if you all could, each of you could just tell us about the folks, just give us a day in the life of the people that live in Nubia and sort of what their day looks like, what the commerce is, what do the families look like, what are they, is it a big city, is it more rural, what does it look like there?
So in the upper northern area, it is a lot more rural. We have houses that are not necessarily shanty, but they're made of brick and mud and things like this, and it's a life just like any other life, It's not as primitive as we see on TV or like this. There is electricity in some areas, and others there aren't. But we wake up, we cook for our families. So the housing there is the mother, the father, the children, sometimes the grandparents. We all live together, and unlike the American society, And we all care for each other. We all make sure that the children, we get up and we go to our universities or we go to our schools. And, you know, we all look after each other. While I was there, actually living in Omdurman, both Omdurman and Khartoum, the daily life for me was to get up with my family and make breakfast, clean the house, and get ready for my university. I was studying at Ahfad University, which is it's a prestigious all-women's university. And it was just a regular day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Professor Maynu, you know, since you, I was wondering with regards to, you know, being in Nubia and living here in the United States, sort of what are some of the differences, the positive differences that you see that are connected to our culture as, you know, people of African descent that you were really happy to see still being sustained by, you know, our people in Nubia. And maybe it's a value that you grew up with and you don't see it as much anymore, but you're really happy that it still exists. Or perhaps it still exists here and you just saw it resonated, which showed us how we're still connected, even despite, you know, our being away from the motherland.
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. You know, and in the Sudan, there's a number of different ethnic groups around the country. And in northern and central Sudan, there's also many different groups. And there's many different groups that will be affected and have actually been affected by the Marowei Dam that was completed in 2008. So there are the Manasir and the Amri. These are two of the groups that were protesting the construction of the major Marowei Dam that I got a chance to go and see, and I spent time among the people there, and their culture is amazing. Like, for example, I went and spent time among the Manasir, and I actually went by myself because my colleague, he was sick that day. He wasn't feeling well, so we were able to find a ride and a local person. We got to these really remote villages, but people were saying you can't go among the Manasir, because the term they said that they were too aggressive. They tried to blow up the Marowei Dam to protect their culture, and it's not safe. But I went on my own because the previous day we tried to go, it didn't work. You had to travel forever through the desert, and we broke down. We got stuck in the desert for 8 hours. But the next day, with motivation and dedication, we were able to get there. So I was there by myself, and I went. I walked up. It was a group of men. These are guys that were supposed to be too aggressive and dangerous. Walked up. The driver said some words for a few seconds. He leaves, takes an errand, and he comes back about an hour later. I sat and talked with the brothers, and we drank tea. We ate dates. And the biggest laugh we had is when I told them about the story that they were too aggressive for anybody to visit them. But these brothers were very hospitable. They were true brothers. They saw me as a brother. They didn't know me from Imhotep, and yet they embraced me. And then before I left, I took my camera out of my bag. I never travel as a tourist or looking like a tourist. I asked them if I can take a picture to document our experience. So the brothers got up from where we were sitting. They went over to their fields with all of the palm trees and said, yes, take a photo of us here. They brought the children there. They took photos. They told me to take photos and video all of their land because they're farmers and they're close to the land. But these brothers and the sisters, they're close to the land. They're honest people. And these are people that are honest. They're balanced. They're not stressed out. It kind of reminds me of the old South. My family's from Alabama, and that's what we see. So whether it's among the Manasir or, you know, the last field work that I was able to do among Nubians in the second cataract area in the north, near the Dow Dam. That's a proposed dam area in the Second Cataract and then the Kashbar area. When they see a brother coming, then they truly treat us just like family. I mean, truly. I mean, all we had to do was just make a phone call. And if they know somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody, and then they say that they have someone coming to visit, that's it. I mean, total African hospitality, just like it used to be in the South here. But the people are close to the land. They're close to the water. Like one of the brothers said, that this is our life. This is our livelihood. This is our grandparent, this water. And to have this taken from us is unthinkable. So this one brother, Ehab, he just took off from his schedule for 2 days to just host us, to host us in order to make sure that our mission was completed. But I just noticed that there's no suspicion. The brothers are just totally open, you know. Households are well kept. Everybody has a distinctive role, the women, the men, the children. So now you got all kind of confusion in the households here that I don't find among the, you know, the folks who are in the village, the villages in Sudan. So it's always a pleasant experience, a chance to really see what life used to be like in terms of people being close to the land, being honest, and not being stressed out every day, dying from heart attack and stroke, as we see here pretty often, but people really enjoying life and wanting to maintain that enjoyment. Even if they don't have 1,000 material things, the people are content. And that's what I notice about spending time among the brothers and sisters in Sudan.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wow, that sounds like a really lovely experience that we definitely don't want to be to disappear or you know, to challenge those lives, which would seem the people that seem to be doing really well and sort of holding on to their values. I was just thinking how throughout the world, you know, looking at sort of how how the world is sort of being taken over by these very corporate structures, one of the first things that happens is the resources become privatized. And you know, you're talking about water. Water is, you know, really important. You think about the land, and then you think about the air, and access to these various natural resources that nobody owns, but you know, governments and internationals come in and they, you know, they stake their claims, you know, like, you know, we did on the moon many, many, many years ago. And it seems like those particular behaviors and actions are not being censored. So it's really great that the two of you and others are raising, you know, the banner and saying, oh, hell, hold up, you know, this is not going to happen. And I want you to give our audience again the details about the fundraiser and information session on Saturday, October 13th. And I know, Professor Maynou, you take lots, so you mentioned the photographs you took, and I'm sure you're going to show those in your great slide presentations. And so I'm sure they're going to be visuals. They
yes,
always are whenever you do anything.
At our event, October 13th, so we'll have, you know, we will kind of have a reception for at 3 o'clock, and by 3:30 we'll start the program, and we will introduce the audience to the project. We have a very very effective 5-minute video overview that one of the brothers has put together who specializes in film editing, and it tells a story. And then I'm also going to then share some of the photos, the insight that I received with my latest field work. So you're right, I want to introduce them to the families, to Brother Ehab and his comments about the need for international support, as well as whatever aid that can be given to help them build local museums to preserve the memory. Then we will have some testimonies. So Sister Amna, we need her on the agenda along with Brother Paradise. to bring the cultural aspect. We also have a special guest, a Nubian brother that will be joining us as well. And then we'll also it's a fundraiser, so we definitely have a raffle and also an auction of some very nice items as well. And but we really think that people will enjoy the event, not only to be informed and to help our project, but they'll be able to meet other positive people who have been or will begin to make positive contributions to what we're doing. And so it's a nice venue at the Linen Life Gallery. It's very easy to find right on International Boulevard. And we've gotten a lot of support from not only Linen Life who are contributing, but also other individuals and businesses who have made donations of things so that we can auction those off in order to generate money for the project. And but we've made a lot of strides over the last several months, and this event will be full. So people should definitely come early because we have been getting an overwhelming number of responses of people who will be in attendance.
Awesome. Excellent, excellent. And again, this Ancient Kush and Nubia Under Threat at the Linen Life Gallery, October 13th, 3 to 6. Linen Life Gallery is located 770 East 14th Street in San Leandro, and it's really easy to find, and it is a beautiful venue. And for more information about the work that that Professor Maynou and Amna and others are doing around Saving Nubia, visit savenubia.org, and you can give there as well. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Brother Maynou, you can, all people can give, make donations there at the website, right?
Yes, exactly. The people can go directly to savenubia.org, mm-hmm. and make contributions on the main page. Alternatively, that's the easy direct way. Alternatively, people can go to PayPal and just put in info at savenubia.org and contribute through PayPal or directly through our website, and it all goes to the same place.
Okay, super. Well, thank you both for joining us, and Professor Maynou, I think we have scheduled another interview in October closer to that date, and maybe Amna, you might be able to join us and do some poetry.
Absolutely, I would love to.
Right,
sounds good to me.
All right. Well, you all both take great care. Lovely to have
you
on today, and continue the wonderful work, advancing the work, as you put it, Professor Maynou.
Thank you so much, Sister Juan. You keep up the good work as well. There's a lot of things you're doing as well, and I know you got a big October coming up with the Ma'afa month. So, mm-hmm. you know, keep up the good work and getting the word out there and using this as an important venue for community organizing. So we appreciate what you're doing.
Oh, you're welcome. You take good care. Peace and blessings.
Okay.
You too.
All right. we're going to close out with Wolf Hawk Jaguar, Aya Daly and Zynga, director of the Lower Bottom Players, mentioned one of her members of the cast, one of the members of the company, Adimu Matyun. He's got this really wonderful piece, and on his latest Hunter poetry, it's called Every Breath of Life. Peace and blessings.
Drinking chocolate milk for free. Told him don't stop shooting, just stop shooting each other. Prosper well, young travelers. Every breath of life, a new beginning. Nothing worth more than a woman with a baby strapped to her back. That's infinite prosperity. Keep your heart pure, actions divine. When Arisha come down, it's hard to tune in time. I often trip when I drive, and my thoughts are of you. I can't wait to see your eyes. I can't wait to see your eyes.
Every breath of life, a new beginning. yelling, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up, wake up. Breathing life, thanks and praise when I paper said another black man died. Too much so, we become desensitized. Tired of being shot down, coming from the side of the town that we come from. Each his own, body, mind, and soul alignment. Recycling lost souls, you know how it goes. Longevity comes very neat. They try to bury me and take away prosperity. But look what y'all just gave me. A brand new little baby. Because of life, a new beginning. Situations, virtues, patience. They say 10,000 chalices lit the night sky. Anticipation, that's how I'm feeling. Blessings on the new journey I've been given. As I taking a deep breath, clean the shrine with sage on the doorsteps. Salvation, blessings, the answers I need you've been given. For the fire, I am.